Let's start with the second session of today. The speaker of this afternoon is Federico Arena. Federico is a researcher of the CONICET Argentina. He is professor of the University Blaise Pascal, and his topics of research are dedicated to legal analysis of legal reasoning, theory of legal interpretation, and analysis of stereotypes. Today he will speak about the epistemic evaluation of believing stereotypes. Federico, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Luca. I would like to start by thanking Diego for having me here. For making room for me, my presentation. Here is, for me, a very great opportunity to have the possibility to discuss some idea with such distinguished colleagues. My main interest, as Luca was saying, is stereotypes in legal reasoning, how stereotypes may affect legal reasoning. And I have been working on that since more or less than 10 years. But I have mostly been focused on stereotypes hiding behind norms. And for example, stereotypes that may affect the way in which the legal order allocates duties and rights. That was the main topic of my initial research. And for instance, a stereotype may hide behind a norm in the case that the norm gives financial aid to women who are the only caregivers of another member of the family. At the first sight, that might seem a beneficial norm for women, but what lawyers behind the legal battles against the discriminatory effects of stereotypes have said is that those kind of norms hide and reinforce stereotypes regarding how the roles should be allocated within family, making women responsible for performing unpaid family care, and then responsible just for providing their families with financial support. That's stated by Carrie Franklin in a paper, The Anti-Stereotype Approach, where she tries to capture what is behind the battle on stereotypes by Ruth Ginsburg in the early 70s. But now I am trying to understand how stereotypes may affect the assessment of evidence in the legal process. And that's another field where scholars on stereotypes have worked. I am just introducing myself in this field. And there are many examples where scholars have pointed out or flagged stereotypes affecting introducing some distortions in the assessment of legal evidence. That's, for example, a recommendation by the CEDAW committee in a case against Italy, where they point out a stereotype that affected the legal reasoning of the assessment of evidence by the Italian court. And they said, for example, a victim of rape must try to resist and escape in all possible ways. But she is to be suspected of fabricating allegation of rape if she has the presence of mind to collect evidence after the assault. And for example, a group of researchers from the Public Defender Office in Argentina have scanned a lot of legal decisions in Argentina by federal courts, and they have identified a set of stereotypes used by judges while assessing evidence. And one of those stereotypes is what they call the strategic woman stereotype. This is the stereotype according to which women accuse their partner of rape in order to obtain an economic advantage, such as keeping the family home. And then that's then a stereotype used in order to disbelieve or not believe in the testimony or the word of the victim. So this is the phenomena that I am interested in. So how stereotypes may affect the assessment of evidence. So one important point in this field is how to evaluate the beliefs on believing stereotypes, the belief based on stereotypes. And this is an important point because within the discussion, mostly advanced by feminist epistemology or the introduction of the gender perspective in the theory of legal evidence, is that we should eradicate all stereotypes of the assessment of evidence. So this is a statement by Julieta Di Corletto. She's an Argentinian researcher, and she says gender stereotypes, usually organized in categories such as honest woman, mendacious woman, strategic woman, corresponsible woman, and fabulated woman, can affect the impartiality of the decision, and so we must ensure its eradication. Maybe this, there is a charitable interpretation of this statement that it's not all stereotypes should be eradicated, just gender-based stereotypes. Maybe I'm not being fair with the statement, but there are more examples of people saying that we should eliminate all stereotypes from the assessment of evidence. But it is also clear that there are other scholars, also from the point of view of gender perspective, that claim that we should distinguish between different kinds of stereotypes. For example, this is a quote by from Miranda Fricker's books, Epistemic Injustice, where she said, we should distinguish between reliable and not reliable stereotypes. When the stereotypes are reliable, they are a proper part of the hearer's rational resources in the making of credibility judgments. But, as she will argue along the book, she will build up a predicament coming from the fact that stereotypes, the kind of stereotypes invoked in the cases that she are interested on, are cases of prejudice stereotypes. So, but there is a distinction. If in the assessing of that testimony you use a reliable stereotype, we are making something epistemically correct. So the point here is, how can we distinguish stereotypes that we may use in our assessment of evidence and stereotypes that we shouldn't use in the assessment of evidence? And that's why I think that we should identify an epistemic norm for stereotypes, which is the norm that we should follow when using stereotypes. And for doing that, and given that I haven't a lot of time to think about it, I'm more or less, I heard before Carlota saying that you were invited to Girona and you said, well, I have to figure out what to say. Well, I was invited to talk in a workshop with philosophers of epistemology, and then I have to find out what to say here. And so we were discussing Professor Williamson's books and also some of his articles, and in the article forthcoming, Justification, Excuses, and Skeptical Scenario, Professor Williamson proposed to distinguish three levels on the identification of norms for belief or for promises. So this is a proposal, this is the first proposal, to identify these three levels of norms regarding stereotypes. The first norm is to increase the probability of an accurate individual judgment, or in another framing, making an accurate individual judgment. That's what you should do when you use stereotypes. Use stereotypes that increase the probability of an accurate individual judgment. The second, or the first derivative norm, this is the S, is the norm according to which you should have the disposition to comply with S. And the third level, the occurrent derivative norm, is do what people that have the disposition to comply with S will do. And in the case of stereotypes, that should be to use stereotypes with statistical support, or accurate stereotypes. And here I am following a proposal by different scholars, such as Li Jusim and Frederick Schauer, that claim that we are epistemically justified to use stereotypes if they are accurate, or if they are supported by statistical information. This is, I think, the standard view on the epistemic evaluation of stereotypes. ODS is the standard view. We should use stereotypes in order to make accurate individual judgment only if they have statistical support. But there is a growing discomfort with ODS. Not all people agree that ODS is a good norm or derivative norm for stereotypes. And there are extra epistemic discomfort, the people that are not worried about whether a statistical supported stereotypes allow us to identify correctly the traits of an individual, but instead they are worried about the fact that the ODS does not allow us to identify other kind of harms that stereotype may produce. So if we worry only about statistical criterion, we wouldn't be able to prevent other harms that stereotypes may cause. So the first is stereotype threat. That's a category advanced by Claude Steele and Aronson, and then there is a book by Steele called Whistling Vivaldi, where he tells us about his experience as a student in Chicago, that a common experience for black people in Chicago is that people walk in the same vereda, and the same sidewalk, used to cross to the other sidewalk when a black people approaches. So he, in order to avoid people changing sidewalk, started to whistle Vivaldi so that they feel more comfortable with these approaching black people. And he said that this is an example of a kind of cloud, black cloud, that some people has because of the fact that they are stereotyped. And one thing that happens when people have this black cloud over their heads is that they tend to confirm the stereotype. So a stereotype, even if accurate, produces the stereotype threat, and people tend to confirm the stereotype. And this has nothing to do with the statistical support of the stereotype. And other scholars like Dolores Morondo, Elena Guidoni from Deusto University, claim that the statistical criterion is too weak in order to battle against stereotypes, because stereotypes, even if statistically supported, reinforce discriminatory practices or social structures. And the ODS has nothing to do with that kind of harms. But there are also epistemic discomfort with ODS. And I will mention just two of them, and I will focus only on the first one. The first one is one that I think we can find in a book by Catherine Padifoot, How Stereotypes Deceive Us. And she makes a very interesting long analysis of stereotypes assessment from an epistemic point of view, but at one point she introduces one claim that I think may be read as a normative proposal regarding the use of stereotypes, that is, to use egalitarian stereotypes. Here, there is a terminological problem here, because she wouldn't call egalitarian generalization and stereotype, but I think that's nothing, has nothing to do with the issue here. So she said we shouldn't use statistical supported stereotypes, we should use instead egalitarian stereotype. And that will allow us to make better individual judgments. And we are going to see in a second a couple of examples to try to make this kind of claim more palpable. And again, I think that a charitable reading of this claim is that it should be the case when we have high moral stakes. So in cases where the moral stakes are high, we should use stereotypes with statistical support if they aren't egalitarian. So we should, in high moral stake cases, we should use only egalitarian stereotypes. And there is this other discomfort with the statistical criterion that came from which we might call, but not only, but this second kind of discomfort is coming from the fact that we should treat some kind of people as individuals, and The basis of this duty may have different sources. Lawrence Bloom, in a paper in 2004, claims that we have this moral general duty to treat other people as individuals. And I think that we may derive this duty also from proponent of moral encroachment. So one consequence of moral encroachment, the fact that we shouldn't treat some people on the basis of a generalization, may also be read as claiming that we should treat them in the basis of their individual traits, individual information. So ODS, the third version of ODS would be to use individual information, do not use stereotypes in cases of high moral stakes. So, and these are the steps of my of the rest of the presentation. This was the introduction, and now the rest of the presentation. I will introduce some cases of uses of stereotypes, assuming that all of them are cases of high moral stakes. That's the proposal. And to see how ODS and the other ODS proposal may bring a solution to the assessment of those cases. Then I will propose how the combination of normative levels proposed by Professor Williams may allow us to better assess those cases, but introducing modification of the different combination of levels proposed by Professor Williams on that paper. I will argue that N, in some cases, at least for some norms, is sufficient for ODN. So that's something that Professor Williams clearly denies, that N is sufficient for ODN. And then I will present with more detail the egalitarian discomfort and why I don't agree with that discomfort. However, even if I don't agree with egalitarian and also moral encroachment or individual discomfort, I think that there is something about the cases that are that they are trying to capture, to explain, which is amiss, epistemically amiss, and I think that I share with them the intuition that there is something epistemically amiss in those cases, but I'm going to try to explain the intuition on another basis. And to that end, I will introduce the idea of the normativity of stereotypes. Not that that's an original idea, but I will introduce that idea in this debate. And that's all. Presupposition of failure was another idea that we will not be talking about today. So this is more or less the cases that are an issue when people discuss about the epistemic evaluation of stereotypes. It's always about stereotypes. For example, that women at math exams in Chile get lower marks than men in the exams in the medium school and for the admission to the university, or the stereotype that staff at Cosmos Club, that is a famous example, I'm going to go through these examples in a second, are generally black people. And there is this kind of stereotype that is very common in the assessment of legal evidence, stereotype about how an idea big green should behave in order to judge that an individual woman is a victim of sexual assault. So that women at math exam in Chile get a lower mark than men has statistical support. That's the plus on the line of statistical support. And very common stereotypes about ideal victims is the stereotype according to which a victim of sexual assault reacts in an active manner when she is confronted with her aggressor. And if the aggressor says a lie, she will react aggressively, she will react actively. And that's a stereotype that, at least as far as I know, has been refute by psychological information statistics. So that's not how victims react in statistics. They tend to react passively because they prefer not to rehearse the moment of the aggression, and they know that discussing with the aggressor will make her rehearse those memories and make the moment of the possibility to rehearse those memories longer, so they tend to be passive in those cases. So at least I will assume that that stereotype has not statistical support. Those stereotypes may match or not with the individual information, may allow us to make correct or incorrect individual, accurate or inaccurate individual judgments. In the case of the women at math exam in Chile, this case where you see a plus is a case where we face a woman that has taken the exam and actually got a lower mark than men. And if we have the minus, it's a woman that had taken the exam and got a higher mark than men. And the same with the staff at Cosmos Club. This is a famous example in the discussion of moral encouragement. The American writer John Hope Franklin was going to receive the Medal of Liberty from the Presidency of the United States. He organized a dinner at the Cosmos Club. Most members of the Cosmos Club are white people. Most members of the staff at Cosmos Club are black people. So at the end of the dinner, he is standing at the exit of the building, and a white woman approaches him, and she will ask him to get her coat, assuming that he is a member of the staff. So that case is a case where the stereotype has statistical support, but does not make an accurate individual judgment. That's the case of Franklin. And the stereotype will make an accurate individual judgment in the case of an actual staff member. And that could happen also with stereotypes with no statistical support. So a stereotype with no statistical support may be followed by correct, accurate individual judgment, in the sense that the judge assumed the non-statistical supported stereotypes, but he correctly identified a woman as a non-victim because she doesn't react actively. When she doesn't react actively, instead he makes an inaccurate individual judgment when he assumes that a woman that doesn't react actively is not a victim when she is actually a victim. So, given what I said about the three levels of norms regarding stereotypes, the first reading is that in cases of low mark staff members, and also in the case, at least at first for reading, in the case of the active victim, N is complied with. People comply with N because the individual judgment is accurate. But there is a difference between case one and case three in the fact that the user of the stereotype in one case complies and in the other case does not comply with ODS. That's because in this case he uses or she uses a statistical supported stereotype, and in this case she doesn't use a statistical support stereotype. So that will be the first explanation of these kinds of cases following these three level norms for stereotypes. And here we have a difficult case, because even if the individual judgment is not accurate, even if at least at first reading the norm or stereotype is not complied with, she complies with ODS because she used statistical support stereotypes, and so at least she's excused. Maybe there is, I think that if we call this excuse or justify, it's not the point here, but following the distinction I used at the beginning, she is excused. Well, what moral encroachment and people who says that we should treat people individual for moral reasons says is that this is a problematic case, because either she's not justified using one terminology, or either she's not even excused in those cases, because she shouldn't use the stereotype in those cases with high moral stake. She should gather more individual information before making the individual judgment. So according to moral encroachment or ODS 3, the problem here is that she violates the ODS by not taking into account individual information. And according to the other this epistemic discomfort that I will focus on, the problem with these two cases is not the fact that she misses or not the individual information. The problem is that she uses an inegalitarian stereotype, and the stereotype according to which white people are from member of the class and black of the club, and black people are member of the staff. And that's a problem, even if in some cases the inegalitarian stereotype may produce individual accurate judgment, because it produces some epistemically deviant dispositions. People with inegalitarian stereotypes will tend to have certain dispositions that will make them prone to make inaccurate individual judgments in the future. So he will have distorted memories. He will try to, for example, as in the case of this woman, Franklin was standing at the front door, but he was wearing a tuxedo, whereas members of the staff were not wearing a tuxedo. So that's something that was ambiguous evidence that she forcefully fit in the stereotype. And so inegalitarian stereotypes produce those kinds of dispositions. Instead, egalitarian stereotypes, even if not statistical supported, produce the contrary disposition. Even given that we think that people do not have differences, at least regarding some traits or some characteristics, then we will not be subject to those kinds of disposition distinguishing between them. So what I try to do is to review this first reading of this first assessment of these four cases in two ways. And this is where this presentation really starts to be a work in progress. I'm going to propose you some ideas and to see, I will be very happy to know if you think that I can go all through the hallway that they open, or I should close the door and there is no exit there. The first point that I would like to do, I will not say nothing about the generalization of this point that I'm going to try to make. This Professor Williams in that article says that we can distinguish regarding promises six possible combinations. There are given that we have three norms, the norm, derivative norm, and the occurrent derivative norm, we should have eight combinations because we have three properties. But there are two cases that are excluded because satisfaction complying with the derivative norm implies that we also comply with the occurrence derivative norm. So those combinations in which the first one is complied with and the second is not are excluded. So there remains six possible combinations. I think that case three is a case that is also a not possible combination of the three norms. And here is the argument. It's the in the case, at least in the case of promises. I don't know if that's generally subject to all other norms, but at least in the case of promises, the case of three is the case, following the example of Professor William, where you promise to give some money to one person, but you are not very disposed to keep the promise. You are not a promise keeper. You are not that person. That's why you don't comply with the second level norm. And you will complain with the third level norm if you do what people who is a promise keeper will do in those occasions. That is, give the money to the person to which you promise to give the money. But it results that the person that you promised to give the money, let's call her Mary, is disguised as another person, and that another person is disguised Amari. So you don't want to give the, you're not disposed to give the money to Mary, that is the real destinatory of the promise, but given that she's disguised in the other person, giving the money to the another person, you give the money to Mary. So the promise norm is satisfied. You comply with the promise norm, but you do not comply with the ODP norm, because you do not do what a person with that disposition would to do, that is, give the money to a person. Well, it seems to me that in that case, we cannot say that we comply with the promise, that the norm of the promise is complied with. And that may follow from a way to understand what it is to promise to do something. And here we follow just von Breit in his book, Norm and Action, just to have one way to present how we understand action. And according to von Breit, an action is the production of a change in the state of affair. And he formalized that in that way. So an action, he uses the letter D because he has used the A in another way in that book, but D is to make a change happen from state of affair B to state of affair Q. So to promise to feel is to promise to bring about a change in the state of affairs through intentional action. That's when I promise you to give you money, I promise you to make a change in the state of affairs in which you don't have the money to the state of affairs in which you have the money through my intentional action. So, I think the most typical cases of promises, you promise to do something to bring about a state of affairs through intentional action. So if this is a good way to understand what it means to promise the fee, I'm sorry, here I should have used D because it's the same formula. Promise to make an action that produces a certain change in state of affairs. P, even if necessary, is not sufficient to keep a promise. The appearance of P is not sufficient to consider that you comply with the promise. To comply with the promise, P has to be the result of an intentional action. So giving the money to a person disguised as the person to which I should give the money is not an intentional action of giving to the person I promised to give the money, because I don't know that. We couldn't say that I carry out an intentional action of which I have promised to do. So in cases like three, P is not the result of an intentional action. And I think that this understanding of what it means to promise something is also supported by standard theory of the justification of promises. I won't go through that here, but we could discuss later, like power theory that defended by Ras, or conventionalist theories like Rawls, expectation theories. I think most expectation theory we wouldn't have reasons to form expectations about the keeping of the general keeping of promises if promises were complied just by chance or not through intentional actions. Only if promises are complied with through intentional action, we have reason to form expectation about the fact that they will be kept in the future. So if this is a good argument, then case three is a case of violation of the norm from stereotypes. So here is not the case that even if ODS has not been complied with, the norm of stereotype has been complied with, is a case with the norm regarding stereotype is not complied with. So that's a really as bad as the second, as the 4K. That's a fair modification on the first reading. And the second step was to assess or to discuss the discomfort with ODS. That is, following S in cases 1 and 2, she, the stereotype bearer, does nothing epistemically amiss. There's nothing epistemologically amiss in what she does, because actually she follows ODS. Another way to say that in the literature is it does not reflect back on her to form her belief on the basis of the stereotype, in the case of Cosmos Club, for example. But according to the first proposal that I attribute to Padifoot, the fault is in the fact that the stereotype is inegalitarian. It produces risky disposition. Oh, the disposition that I have mentioned before. But I think that there are, even if there are some arguments for the egalitarian norm stereotypes, for stereotypes, this is one of the arguments that Padifoot put forward to defend her proposal. I think I have still 5 minutes, or?
Yes.
Stereotype with statistical support may nevertheless produce epistemic costs. Egalitarian stereotypes may avoid those costs. And she uses the example of Tim, who grew up in a society where men and women are equally well represented in STEAM disciplines, and who now lives in a society where that is not the case. Given the condition in which he grew up, Tim holds an accurate and egalitarian belief that men and women are equally represented in science, at least where he came from. Now he moves to UK, where Padifoot says that would be an inaccurate stereotype. In UK, men and women are not equally represented in STEM disciplines. However, that's why that attitude does not reflect the reality of the society in which he currently lives. Such a belief that falsely represents the world as more egalitarian, at least in the UK, than it really is, can bring epistemic benefits, most notably the benefit of avoiding distortion of case-specific information. So using an egalitarian but statistically not supported, inaccurate stereotype may produce benefit, epistemic benefit. That is, for example, if he encounters a woman that is part of the STEM disciplines, he will be prone to attribute to her the characteristic of not being part of the discipline, because a woman can be just as a man part of that discipline. But I think that there are problems with egalitarian norm stereotypes. I think that egalitarian stereotypes are subject to analogous pitfalls, that being generalizations, also egalitarian stereotypes produces blind spots. That is, if I I'm a Chilean professor who needs to assess if wannabe, sorry for the expression, student has good math abilities, and I interview a woman that has taken the math exam for admission to university, and I attribute to her the characteristic of having had a low mark in math, I will be certainly using complying with ODS according to given that the stereotype has statistical support. But now, if I so Padiful said you should use an egalitarian stereotype, even if it doesn't have statistical support, and that will allow you to not misidentify a woman that has got a high mark on the math exam. But having an egalitarian stereotype will again produce the opposite pitfall. That is, if a woman that has got a low mark on the math exams and I use an egalitarian stereotype, I will risk a misattribution and inaccurate individual judgment even using an egalitarian stereotype. So I think that the cost of inegalitarian stereotypes I reproduce also by egalitarian stereotypes. So there is no actually epistemic reason for that. And also taking into consideration that she proposes this norm to apply in cases of high moral stakes, I think that the epistemic norm stereotype may conceal morally relevant differences, like in the cases of victims of sexual aggression. To think that certain women act differently in cases of sexual aggression is morally relevant in order to be able to identify the correctly identify victims of sexual aggression. So there are cases in which differences are relevant, inegalitarian stereotypes are relevant in order to make accurate, morally relevant judgments. So even if I disagree, and this is the last point, I promise I finish, with those two proposals, even if here I focus only on the one I have attributed to Padiful, I think that there are something in cases one and two that are cases that the egalitarian proposal and the moral encroachment individual proposal try to explain better, that are problematic. And I think that comes from the fact that even stereotypes are frequently conceived as, for example, widely held association between a given social group and one or more attributes, so generalizations about groups that associate groups with certain traits or characteristics. Stereotypes, even in the battles, in the legal battles against stereotypes, have also a different function. And they also function as norm, not just as generalization. And that, for example, have been pointed out by Appiah in Stereotypes in the Making of Identity, a text from 2000, where he claims that stereotypes may also be grounded in a social consensus about how members of a group ought to behave in order to conform appropriately to the norms associated within membership in the group. So stereotypes sometimes are norms, not generalization. We can certainly, this is just a case of the same term used to make reference to two different phenomena, generalization belief and norm. But what I think is interesting this, and the fact that looking at the normativity of stereotype, is that many works on psychology says that stereotype may have both functions in the reasoning of the verbs. So the descriptive component, said Burgess and Borgida, of gender stereotypes consists of beliefs about characteristics that women possess, whereas the prescriptive component consists of beliefs about characteristics that women ought to possess. So stereotype beliefs are beliefs that has this, and this is this normative component, and this is where I am trying to, where I am making the first steps. That's how can I capture the fact that stereotype belief has this normative component that in some cases may produce an inversion of the direction of fit, for just to try to put it in some expression. That is, the bearer of a normative stereotype, or of a stereotype with normative component, may end up abandoning epistemic goals, limiting himself to disapproving of the behavior of those who do not fit the stereotype, and constructing the facts in such a way that it is possible to inflict some kind of punishment. So, in the case of for example, of the Cosmos Club, the problem with the way in which the woman uses the stereotype is that actually what she seems to be doing is to inflict a kind of punishment to Franklin for not being in his place. So he is a black man in the Cosmos Club. She should be part of the staff. She is a woman that hasn't worn the correct dress, has shown her leg, so she deserves to be assault. It will be assault. She consented the sexual act. Woman shouldn't be interested in math. So saying that she is bad at math is a way to punish her for not complying with the stereotype. So people using stereotype mostly. At least this is my proposal, my intuition, at least in cases of high moral stakes, are seeking or different direction of fit at the end of the day. They are inflicted punishment to those. So obviously it cannot be shown in just one short case, but you need to see how that person will behave in other cases. But maybe that's how we can explain what is a miss in the case of number two, and even in high stake cases, in cases like number one. The problem with that woman at the Cosmos Club, or maybe with a math professor in Chile, is that they violate the norm, the second level norm, the disposition to behave as the stereotype norms. Because in using the stereotype with a normative component, they do not pursue, they not try to make accurate individual judgments. Instead, they try to punish who does not fit the stereotype. So that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your interesting presentation. Let's open the floor to the question, Professor Williams.
Yeah, so I guess I better talk about the challenge that you were giving about the case of promising. So this was an example where somebody, as I describe it, kept their promise but didn't have a disposition to keep their promises, and also didn't do what a person who did have such a disposition would do, because of the disguise scenario. So, and you were avoiding that description of the case by saying that if I promised to do something, then I promised to intentionally do it. So I have various things about it. One is, I don't think it has anything to do with the von Richt quotation that you gave, because that didn't say anything about intentions. It was just promising to bring about a change in the state of affairs, which is done in that case. The second is, of course, if you simply have a rule that whenever you promise to fie, you also promise to intentionally fie, then that will mean that you also promise to intentionally fie, and so on ad infinitum. So there's already, and you're, in fact, you're making an infinite number of promises, most of which you won't be able to keep because you can't have that number of embeddings of intention. The argument you were giving was that, or that you were quoting other people as giving, was that in some way, if you you know, intention. I mean, the institution of promising has to do with people's intentions, and so on. We'd break down without them. So, I don't think you can just read off the content of intentions from, you know, what may be a plausible story about the evolution of the institution of promising, because it's perfectly possible to make and break or keep promises that whose tendency is to undermine the institution of promising. So, for example, I can, you know, if I have two friends and I make a promise to one of them, I can, you know, when the other finds out and is offended, I can promise the second friend I will break my promise to the first friend. And if I don't break my promise to the first friend, then the second friend can rightly accuse me of having broken my promise to her. And so that's, I'm not talking about the intention case here, I'm just talking about the fact that this is a kind of promise that it makes perfectly good sense to make, and and just operates in the kind of normal way of promises, even though obviously by making a promise to break a promise, then that does have a tendency to undermine the institution of promising. But that doesn't mean that it's somehow, you know, invalid as it stands or anything like that. I just don't think, I mean, you know, just as a free can be compatible with, you know, with some free speech law that people publish books against free speech, you know, it's possible in the promising case. And I think, in fact, that there's a very good reason for not using philosophical considerations to make kind of ad hoc tweaks on what counts as keeping your promise, because it means that the standard of promise keeping becomes much less accessible to ordinary people. I mean, you know, because it means that, you know, the just a very straightforward standard of promise keeping, that if you promise to fi, then what you need to do in order to keep your promise is to fi. You know, but if that can be undermined by, you know, kind of abstruse philosophical considerations about the evolution of the institution of promising, then, you know, from the point of view of ordinary users of the institution, all bets are off, because who knows what kind of elaborate philosophical stories people can justify, use to justify their promise breaking or their accusations of promise breaking or whatever it is. So it's actually, you know, from the point of view of, even of the institution of promising, it's much better to have a completely straightforward rule that when you promise to fi, what counts as keeping your promise is fine, and that's it.
Okay, thank you for all the commentaries. I think you're right regarding Fonbury, that I was using his way of understanding change and action just to try to make my point clear, but I don't think that my argument follows from what he said. I think I don't agree with the two last points regarding the fact that a practice the two last point, the one about the fact that we cannot figure out what practice demands from the justification of the practice, because an invalidating or a promise to break a promise is a perfectly understandable promise within the practice of promise, and it doesn't fulfill the justification of the practice. Or I think that if I understood. But One thing is to say that the practice make room for this kind of action, and another thing is that the norm of the practice does not determine exactly what it is to fulfill this justification. The practice of promises admits exceptional cases of promise to keep promises. If all people that promise will start to do this kind of thing, the practice of promise will fall out. I will fall, I think, because we could not be just we could not have any kind of certainty about the fact that someone that promised me to do something will keep his promise, because the practice is that we can promise not to keep our promise. So,
but nobody's suggesting that it becomes a practice of everybody saying that they're going to break their promises. I mean, obviously, if everybody's promising to break their promises, things are that's going to make trouble for the institution. But that's that doesn't stop it. I mean, the fact that there might be something dysfunctional if everybody made a certain promise doesn't mean that it's dysfunctional if one person makes it. I mean, it will be dysfunctional if one person can promise to visit Girona, but if everybody in the world promises to visit Girona, then there's going to be a big problem for Girona. But that's okay because they're not going to promise that, and so there's no particular difficulty in making a promise to break a promise to someone else, because I mean it may not be a nice promise, but it's still a promise, and the fact that one person makes it doesn't in fact do anything significant to undermine the institution of promising. And the institution of promising, quite a significant proportion of promises are broken. I mean, that's obvious looking around. I mean, I don't know what it is, but maybe 30%, I wouldn't be surprised, that promises are, I promise never to do that again. I mean, that promise is usually broken. So the institution of promising is actually extremely robust and survives quite high levels of promise breaking. And so I don't think the fact that if everybody was to promise to break their promises, the institution would break down, it really shows anything about whether that's a promise that is. You might think there's something immoral about it, but it's a perfectly possible promise to break and in making it, you do undertake an obligation to the friend to whom you made the promise to break the promise to the other friend or ex friend.
Yes. I'm not quite convinced. Nevertheless, think of the legal practice. No, we are talking about promises, but just to make an example of one action that is allowed with the practice, but cannot be allowed as a general action if the practice is to survive. That is, judges that do not accept the fundamental rule of the legal order, the way in which we should identify legal norms. So, actually, the critics of this point of view, the fact that in legal orders we have a master rule that allows us to identify legal norms, said, well, there are judges that do not follow that rule, but nevertheless are judges, nevertheless keep their office. And the legal order, nevertheless, functions not so well as the practice of promises. Everybody maybe is also violating legal norms, but the system is standing. But the point is, we could have a legal order where all judges does not follow the master rule of the legal order. Well, I think that if the answer is no, this is where I should keep thinking, that may give us reason to think that the fact of following the master rule is follows from the justification of having a legal order.
Yeah, but
what
you could perfectly well have is a situation with two tribes that are enemies of each other, mm-hmm. and it's a law in one tribe that that everyone at some point in their life has to go into the territory of the other tribe and break one of the other tribe's laws. That's a closer analogy to the example that I was giving. That would be perfectly possible. I mean, you know, just as you could have two gangs in each of which it was a rule that you had to go into the other gang's territory and break one of their rules. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, you know, maybe there are real life cases of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Yeah, and on the third point, I think that's a very good lesson on philosophical argument that we shouldn't use that kind of abstruse arguments in order to say what common practices are. But at least I can say I'm not alone on that. That's a very common philosophical practice. Thanks for the.
I am looking here by Professor Papayannis on the topics, and then I will follow the other questions.
Very little point about promising. Do you think that there is a difference between keeping a promise and not breaking it? Because sometimes I think we can capture Federico's intuition there. Suppose the promise is a little different. I ask you to take care of my child, and then you don't intend to take care of my child, but you confuse another people's child with my child. You'll be keeping your promise even if you take care of my child without knowing it was my child. I wouldn't say that you are trustworthy, that you kept your promise, just you didn't break it.
Yeah,
I think this captured what people wanted to do.
Yeah, I think the thing is that quite a lot may be built into the taking care of accusation. And, you know, so it's not enough that the child survives, unhurt from this experience. I mean, there's an epistemic aspect to taking care. I mean, that is that you have to, roughly speaking, you have to know that the child is okay. And so, in that epistemic part is not being satisfied in your example.
Professor Pavese?
Yes. Yes, I wanted to ask you, so you were arguing the egalitarian stereotypes may cost as well as negative stereotypes. So there is a particular kind of cost that goes with negative stereotypes that you didn't discuss. I wonder if you think that also applies to egalitarian. So negative stereotypes are well known in psychology for being self-reinforcing, right? So in the sense that, the experiments about the Asian woman, some of them were identified as women who underperformed the tests, on the math test. When the group who instead was stereotyped as Asian would actually overperform very well perform on the, as well as. So that's a clear cost for negative stereotyping, right? This seems like we have plenty of evidence that was replicated. And, it's not clear to me that egalitarian stereotypes will have that kind of cost, right? The very social heavy negative cost. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if the argument that you were considering and rejecting in favor of changing things would apply here as well. Or do you think that it can be restated by pointing out that particular cost, which is kind of undeniable, is social and epistemic. It seems because these people actually would do much better on epistemic tasks by stereotyping themselves as Asian rather than women.
Yes, I think there are a few points there. The first one is that I discuss here the fact that egalitarian stereotypes produce epistemic benefits, allow us to make accurate individual judgment, and I think that there is no. At least, I try to argue that they don't. But I agree that they may produce some social benefits to have egalitarian, even if false, stereotypes. That may be the case. I don't think that that's a necessary property of egalitarian.
Social, it seems to me like if there wasn't a negative women's stereotype about more women would be mathematicians.
But for example, in that case, if this stereotype or generalization that has statistical support in Chile, that women get lower marks than men in math exams for the admission to the university, will say, well, it will be better to avoid this kind, not to have this egalitarian stereotype, this inegalitarian stereotype, has egalitarian stereotype regarding the abilities of men and women on math exams. But that will preclude all, I think, that's my perception, that will preclude all educational policies in order to put an end to the ways in which little girls are educated, brought up in this idea that women shouldn't be interested in math. So if we have the inegalitarian stereotype, our educational policy will be justified on the fact that if we don't do that, women will have lower marks in their math exam. So having inegalitarian stereotypes, for example, knowing that women has less licenses than men, got less, well, that's an inegalitarian stereotype. That doesn't mean that women are less interested in car than men, but allow us to have maybe a social policy in order to encourage women to have those solutions. So, in egalitarian stereotypes,
so it's understanding, and it suggests that they are more softer, so they need more. That's one way you can reach a better education for them. Another is, look, let's drop those stereotypes and let's, like, they are rooted in our culture from the start, and see what happens. When that happens, and you know, chances are, given what we know about psychology stereotypes, that women will be much better.
Maybe the case, yes.
Professor Moreno?
No.
Marco Segatti.
Thank you. So, I think I want to fight the premise, so to speak. So, the premise of the argument is that there are some kind of stereotypes that are statistically accurate, and these we can use epistemically, at least in individual judgments. But this is, I mean, I'm not sure whether there are, but it's very difficult to tell. I mean, take the club case. So suppose that 100% of the staff is, I don't know, black or called Marco, and 2% of the audience is called Marco. Now, you'd be, in your presentation, it seems as though you'd be justified in assuming that somebody, you meet somebody here and say, oh, I'm Marco. Oh, you're a member of the staff. You would be justified to believe that. But suppose that there is 1 million people in the audience and 10 people in the staff. There are 2% of Marco among 2 million people. That's 200, I don't know, can't make the calculation. Very many people that are called Marco in the audience. Many more than there are in the staff. There are only 10. So, you see what I'm saying? I mean, it's 100% people in the staff are called Marco.
Okay.
But only 2% in the audience are called Marco. But if you have a very big audience and a very small staff, you're not authorized to infer from the fact that a person is named Marco that he's a member of the staff. Because there could be very many more Marco in the audience than are in the staff in absolute numbers. So that the probability that the guy is called Marco and is a member of the staff is very slim. I mean, you can think of the example, add millions and billions and, you know. So in those situations, I mean, it is statistically accurate to say that 100% of the people in the staff is called Marco, but the way you use that individual judgment depends on very many other factors that, you know, kind of confuse the individual judgment. So what I'm saying is, it's not that easy to go from the statistically accurate to the individual judgment. It depends on the scenario and what you're using the judgment for.
Yes, but as I understand that point, even if I am afraid of the quantity of Marco, I hope that's what I meant. But as I understand that point, I think that's a question about how to use statistics correctly. That's And the point will stand even if you say that though. And I think that it's enough for the point to say that there are at least some cases in which you are justified in doing that with a generalization about people's characteristic. I think that, we should make the way in which you use statistic more precise. We should refine our understanding of the use of statistic, but if that, once we do that, we can refine the conditions to use statistic in order to identify or to make accurate individual judgment, I think that the point will still stand.
I have a finger by Professor.
Yeah, okay. So just an example of a stereotype that I think we all rely on, and I don't think we're going to stop relying on it, is a stereotype that, you know, broadly speaking, children are less epistemically competent than adults. I mean, that, you know, and of course, you know, we can easily think of cases of 12-year-old children who are, you know, more epistemically competent than many 30-year-olds and so on. But still, I mean, this is the basis on which 12-year-old children don't have the vote. And, you know, and I don't think it's... there are probably statistics out there that would support this, but I don't think that's even the basis on which most people think that it's absolutely fine to, you know, for children not to have the vote. So that seems like a case where we're all relying on, I mean, pretty much we're all relying on stereotypes, because, I mean, not many of us know actually some statistics that show that, you know, that average 12-year-olds are less epistemically competent than average 30-year-olds, and it actually seems okay.
That's a point about the distinction, the directo and the dicto, the rea and the dicto. I think this is a requirement, the rea or the dicto, but I have to think. I am interested in the assessment of evidence in the legal process where you cannot use in that way generalization.
Yeah, but
so you are required to.
But there are rules about children's evidence, aren't there? I mean, children's evidence will not be treated in the same way as the evidence of an adult.
Yes.
So that there are, you know, there are all kinds of asymmetries in the treatment of children and adults in the law as you know, and it includes in all kinds of the, you know, the classic test cases like who gets the vote, and that, which are based fundamentally on stereotypes and which seem extremely defensible, even once we realise that they are based on stereotypes.
Okay, but so the point is that as we use stereotypes, statistical support is not a necessary condition in the practices where we consider them their use justified.
But even if we had some statistics, I'm sure we could get some statistical evidence. I mean, mm-hmm. it is out there. But the point is that these are cases where we're completely inegalitarian. Mm-hmm. You know, mainly on the basis of stereotypes, but it could also get some statistical support, but where that seems a, you know, perfectly reasonable attitude to take. Mm-hmm.
Professor Kruger?
I really appreciate your presentation, Federico. And thinking about the possibility to talk about the second-order stereotypes, these stereotypes about stereotypes.
Yes. Mine.
let me show an example. In Colombia's coffee-growing region, the owners of a coffee plantation hired the man as a head of the staff, foreman. he and his wife were entitled under the working conditions to live in a house on the plantation. One day, a fire broke out, and the man died while his wife was injured. It was proven that the house did not meet the necessary safety standards to prevent fires. Subsequently, she requested compensation for her husband's death and for the injuries she sustained as a worker of the plantation. The owners agreed to pay for her husband's death, but refused to compensate her for her injuries, arguing that she was not an employee of the company. They claimed that she was only allowed to live in the house as a benefit for her husband. She took the matter to the court. The case was decided against her claims in both the first and second instance. However, the Supreme Court of Colombia ruled that the case should be judged with a gender perspective, whatever it means. To do so, it would be necessary, the Supreme Court said, to understand that in Colombia's coffee growing region, all plantations hired married men as for women, only them, assuming that their wives will live in the house and perform caregiving tasks and cook for the workers, etc. The man is hired and the wife is implicitly included in an auxiliary work role. She's part of the contract, even if she does not formally have a contract in her name. In summary, the court applied an epistemically justified stereotype to rule in favor of the woman. In a case like this, resolving by applying an egalitarian stereotype would have been manifestly unjust, I think. I believe this is a good example of the injustice of applying a second-order stereotype, according to which stereotypes, even if they are epistemically justified, are morally undesirable. What do you mean?
In the sense that the stereotype according to which women in plantations devote their time to
caregiving
activities, even if that stereotype is accurate, the fact that they do that is
an egalitarian
fact.
And assuming, in order to rule this case, an egalitarian stereotype makes an unjust decision for the case. There is no moral reason, I think, to assume an egalitarian stereotype against an egalitarian stereotype that is epistemically justified.
Yes, yeah, so maybe that's, as I would understand the case, is a case in which an egalitarian stereotypes function in favor of a victim of the inequality. That's another maybe example of cases where inegalitarian stereotype may produce social positive consequences or benefits.
For epistemic reasons, in this case.
Yes, because they allow to accurately identify what happened in that case. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that, I think that that's how I will read that the case. Yes. So thank you. That's a good example.
Thank you. More questions? Have I missed someone?
I mean, if there's time, so I'm sure you have, but on the relationship between stereotypes and generics, just a very wide and ill-formed question.
Yes, the discussion about the accuracy of stereotypes
right.
in some cases, in not all the literature is a discussion about the accuracy of generics, claiming that stereotypes do not function as generalization but as generic instead. And mm-hmm. yes, there is a connection.
Edgar.
I was wondering if you have a take on, if you think about certain types of evidence, for instance, character evidence that is normally or under certain conditions admitted in courtrooms. Because you might say that character evidence is kind of information regarding the past behavior of a person, and basically we are generalizing it on his or her past behavior. And would this give rise to the kind of reflection that you are inviting us today to have?
I think that will be an example of this, of the effects. That will be an example of a case in which we want to avoid the effects of the normative dimension of stereotypes. So, to forbid the introduction of that kind of evidence is not only to preclude the possibility of epistemic errors in the assessment of the evidence of the case by the juror or the judge, but also to avoid the application of a normative or stereotype of the effects of the normative dimension of stereotypes.
Just because some might say that in disregarding, for instance, free will, or that people might behave differently mm-hmm. in the future, you could say that you're treating them disrespectfully if you consider character evidence against them, for instance. But not only disrespectfully, but also this might be a case of insensitive evidence in the sense that it wouldn't change if it is false that the accused, for instance, didn't commit the crime. Mm-hmm. So you would still have this, for instance, information about the past behavior of the person. Maybe that is the case. She or he is an angry person, reacts violently when confronted with certain types of situations. And still, if it were false that she or he didn't commit the crime she is accused of, you would have the same evidence. So the evidence okay. would have the so-called tracking capability.
Okay.
That some other evidence has, mm-hmm. and it creates problems. I'm not trying to push you to say that we shouldn't admit character evidence, but only just.
Yes. Yes. No. I misunderstood the example. I thought that the example was the ban on evidence about the past sexual behavior of a victim. And that was, I thought, maybe read as a rule against the normative dimension of stereotype, trying to avoid the effects of the... But I would think about that example.
Any other question?
Can I, just on the character evidence, there's been a huge scandal in Britain where I think thousands of people who are running little post offices were, in some cases, imprisoned, in most cases, lost their jobs and so on because of what turned out to be some computer screw up, but where it seemed that they were defrauding the post office, and they were, I think, a lot of the key evidence that has brought to light the fact that all these people were innocent was massive character evidence. You know, these were just, I mean, in their favour, that these yes. were just extremely law-abiding people mm-hmm. who'd never been in any other kind of trouble. So, I mean, you know, there definitely is a positive role that character evidence sometimes plays. So a huge injustice was basically uncovered and to some extent reversed, not fully, but because of character evidence.
Diego?
Very little thing, Federico. Don't you think that using stereotypes is always involves some kind of disrespect to the people's stereotypes? Because you're not taking seriously whatever they do actually do in their life. You're saying, okay, you're of that kind, you're part of that, and stereotypes always involve some exaggeration, etc. Even if egalitarian stereotypes might be disrespectful. So you might have a conflict between your epistemic use of stereotypes that might be justified, that's just not a normal justification, but
yes.
also another reasons that might recommend not using stereotypes at all.
Yes, I don't think so, that using stereotype is always disrespectful. And it's true that there are positive stereotypes that may nevertheless be disrespectful. For example, this is what Miranda Fricker calls a hurting compliment. Or hurtful compliments, something like that. That is, well, if in this meeting, this I say to Marianela, you are very intuitive. Women are intuitive. Maybe intuitive in some context may be something positive, but in a seminar on philosophy and we are discussing abstract ideas, that would be a hurtful compliment. And also people from the Caribbean are a good dancer. Well, that may be a positive characteristic. I wish I would be a good dancer, but in some context that is, well, they are not very good at serious activities or something. So there are cases of that. But there are other cases in which we use stereotype like belief or generalizations about to interact with people, and I think that's not disrespectful. Before we were talking with Diego about the matricula de honor, about the fact that you said that a particular student is deserves some kind of recognition and pay less of the fees, of the university fees. And that's based on generalization about how he answer to a test, and you said people who answer like he did in the test is good at this object. So it
they have another use. Example, because I think that's a price. If you get the top, you are the top of the class, next course is for free. That's a price. I mean, it's not stereotyping. You're not stereotyping. You're not including someone, but some feature that it's out of his control. For example, me being born in Argentina, it's out of my control. You're not including me.
Okay, but we all of this and not disrespectful stereotypes are currently being discussed, I guess. But for example, age. We use generalizations based on age in order to determine who can vote, who can get a driver license, who can get married, and we use a lot of generalization based on age. They are being currently discussed, that's true. Ageism is a trend on the field of stereotypes, but at least at this point, we accept that generalizations, at least some generalization based on age, are not necessarily disrespectful.
For example, because you are saying to someone very capable, 17-year-old, look, I know more than you about the actual political reality, I don't care. I don't care what you do. Look, you are too old to be a professor. No, but I'm perfectly capable. I just published a great book. I don't care. You are for retired. So, and that's disrespectful. That's what it is. I'm not sure whether this is true of all stereotypes, but I think that this is a strong component in all stereotypes for being potentially dangerous. And in this sense, the epistemic value you might find in some cases provided you, well, maybe it's in conflict with other interests. We have a society of not using, banning the use of stereotypes altogether.
Yes, I think there are maybe other or cases, if you don't like the age or the establishment of social aids. So there is given that distinguishing between people that deserve some social aid make room for corruption, some legal order started to generalize, make the most wide generalizations to determine who should receive some social aid. And for example, the universal social aid for children in Argentina is everyone who has a child receives that social aid. It doesn't matter if it has a certain income, education, and that's based on the fact that each of them is treated on the basis of generalization, and I don't think we will say that they are treated in a disrespectful way.
I think in Chile and I were talking about you apply for a scholarship, and if you are a descendant of I don't know how you call it, Aborigines, descendant of the native people,
indigenous.
There, you get extra pointing. Even if you don't want it, even if you don't think you need it, no, you get a special treatment because of your roots. Who cares about my roots? Just evaluate to our assess. Some people might have legitimate claim to that their application be assessed only on this, based on its content and not their origin. And I don't know. I think it's bad.
The point is, it is always disrespectful to treat a person as a member of as a member of a group, or not as an individual.
So I'm just going to say that I think Juan is right about the connection between stereotypes and generics, and you know, the generics basically are the contents of stereotypes. But there's also quite a lot of evidence from cognitive psychology that generics are more basic than standard quantificational constructions, and so that so our understanding of quantification, I mean quantification in the logical sense, is built on our competence with generics. So, and you know, given that thinking in generic terms, it basically is thinking in terms of stereotypes. If we were to ban thinking in terms of stereotypes, if you could really, as it were, surgically remove that from someone's head, you would probably have removed their capacity to handle quantificational statements in general.
I have a finger on that finger. I was going to say that sand coarse graining is inevitable and necessary. So then, once you accept that, we're fighting over the degree. I don't treat you as the kind of DNA that you have,
down
to the genes. Yeah.
Maybe if I can step in over this topic, if I give myself the word.
Yes.
We can. In fact, I don't know very much about this literature, but I am always puzzled when I listen to these kind of talks, because it seems to me that we are conflating things that are partially different, because maybe the stereotype, at least as we perceive it in the common discourse, it has also an evaluative sting, a kind of, which it is not exactly a generalization. Maybe a generalization is something more neutral, more open to be refined, open to be, whereas the stereotype is something that we use in order to put someone in a place which is, and with that evaluative connotation. So maybe it can be the case that we can still differentiate. We cannot conflate generalization and stereotype, because stereotypes, it involves something different. I don't know, just an impression.
Yes. Well, first of all, maybe this is an internal joke, but I never thought you would use a Dworkinian term in order to make a point, like steam. But I think that if we look at how the term is used in the literature on psychology and how it's used in some legal cases, there are the phenomenon to which that the term points is belief or statement that express beliefs that's descriptive statement. So, and that's why in psychology they had a very sharp discussion about the accuracy of stereotype. There's a book by Jacine that's called The Unbearable Accuracy of Stereotypes, because psychologists, at least at the beginning, thought that stereotypes were only overgeneralizations or inconsistent generalization, and they were starting a line of research trying to show that people has accurate stereotypes. So, for example, how some students from Canada do in some kind of exam, there were stereotypes about them. So, and we have the way to establish. So at least within the psychology literature, at least within some legal decisions, the term refers to a descriptive phenomenon. And I think that, but I agree with your with something that follows from your point, that is that we nevertheless pay attention to the fact that stereotype have in many contexts that component, that normative component. I'm trying to figure it out how to capture that component with certain analytical categories. I'm not sure that my proposal here is maybe the correct one, but I think that that component has some consequences on their descriptive side also.
Other question? Fingers? Hands? Feet? I don't know.
Just perhaps, maybe it's not just so much about a problem with generics, but with the difficulty of getting rid of them in the situation. I mean, many times it's okay to, I guess, make an individual judgment based on a stereotype, but it's not okay to not be sensitive to the small information and kind of destroys the stereotypical information. Mm-hmm. So, like you see in the friend things example, you see all waiters there, all members of the staff have a secret uniform, and the guy is black and is wearing a black tie, and he still insists, because he's black, that he's got to work there. Now, that is stupid. You know, even before the races. So perhaps that's the problem. I don't know.
Yes. Yes, that's something I didn't talk about here, that's maybe some refinements of ODS, of the statistical or accuracy criterion, that has to do with which are the conditions under which we can we are justifying using the stereotypes, that the accurate stereotype. And one of those conditions is that there is no individual information that contradicts the stereotype. That we have to deal with that before using that. But I think that's a refinement of the ODS.
Okay, so we can close here the second session. Thank you very much for the
interview.